So, hello, Oliver Kim here. Topic 4, ecology, on page 54. Modes of nutrition. That is basically the heading of this page. Top left, population and species. Let's define some terms here. Species are organisms that are capable of interbreeding. So, in other words, they can continue to maintain their own kind into the future. Okay? They can potentially interbreed, and their offspring also has to be fertile. I will give you a counterexample. A horse and a donkey are two different species. They can interbreed. The offspring is a mule. However, a mule is sterile, and you cannot cross two mules to get another mule. Okay, so species must be capable of interbreeding, and then at the same time, the offspring must be fertile as well. A population are a group of organisms, species, that lives at the same place at the same time. So we not only talk about human populations right now, but we can also talk about plant populations, certain plants. Okay, so it must be of a certain species, and then they have to live in a certain geographical region at the same time. So that is some two basic definitions. Now the thing is the following. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to jump over very briefly into page 55, where it says communities and ecosystems, because I would like to continue the explanation there. A community are several populations that are interacting with each other. And the easiest form, or the most common way of interacting, would be predation. So one species chasing and eating the other species, okay? And it is the next thing is that if you have a community and its abiotic environment, which is its non-living environment, wind, weather, temperature, whatever, then you refer to this as an ecosystem. So we have species, populations, communities, which are several populations interacting with each other, and then we have an ecosystem where we also start to introduce the non-living, the so-called abiotic environment. So I had to do this because it kind of belongs together. We're back on page 54. And we talk about feeding, nutrition, and modes of heterotrophic nutrition. What is a heterotroph? A heterotroph are those organisms that need organic material for food. So they have to eat food, and they will get the energy out of the food that they eat. And there are now three subcategories of heterotrophs, the so-called saprotrophs. And what they do is they digest dead organisms, dead material, by releasing enzymes and then absorbing the nutrients. Consumers are, they eat other organisms by eating them, and what they do is they chase living organisms and they kill them and they eat them. So we are consumers, so we eat plants and animals. And the detritivores are those organisms that also ingest, they also have a digestive system, they eat other organic material, but this organic material is dead and decaying. Earthworms, for example, are detritivores. Saprotrophs and detritivores are decomposers, okay? And consumers are not. Autotrophs and heterotrophs, the box on the left. An autotroph is an organism, a plant, and certain bacteria are autotrophs, and what they do is they are able to make their own food using sunlight and carbon dioxide. And while heterotrophs, as I just mentioned, they need organic material. There are also heterotrophic plants and algae. Well, most plants are autotrophs. However, it is possible that under certain circumstances, they have to rely on organic material. But this is not the rule. Okay. So in biology, there are always certain exceptions. We continue on page 55, and I already explained communities and ecosystems. I did not explain yet food web. In the communities box, and that is a feeding relationships. These are the so-called food webs, okay? And the food webs indicate the energy flow inside an ecosystem. We also have a mesocosm, and a mesocosm is one of the required experiments that you do. Over here you have a glass jar, and the idea is the following, that it's completely sealed off, so it is a closed system concerning materials and substances and nutrients. No food is able to enter the mesocosm, but it is an open system concerning light energy, because light energy is, of course, allowed to enter. So then we move on to do a little bit of statistics on page 55, top left corner, quadrant sampling of communities. So for example, if you would like to know the number of flowers in a certain area, How you go the flower density, what you do is you divide the area into quadrants, into squares, and then you randomly choose the squares, and then you count the flower density in these squares, and then you do a little bit of math to determine the overall average flower density. But what you do is you generally don't count everything, but you simply make quadrants first, because it is not necessary to count everything. It's time enough, you have consumes too much time to count everything. Sometimes it's enough if you simply sample individual quadrants, and then you do a little bit of math, and then you extrapolate from that to determine the average population density in the whole area. Next box, using the chi-squared test, would kind of go a little bit beyond the scope to explain you how it works, but I will simply tell you the significance, the importance of this. This shows whether certain data is significant or not. So there is when you do sampling, you always have a variation, and usually the observed values always deviate from the theoretical values. So if you flip a coin, theoretically you still have a 50-50 chance, but in real life it's really 50-50. So how far away are you allowed to go from the theoretical expected value 50-50 when flipping the coin for the answer still to be valid? Let's say you flip the coin 10 times, you get not five heads and five tails, but you get six heads and four tails. Is this still, should we still count this as a valid 50-50 chance, or is the coin manipulated? So that's the question. Most of us intuitively would say, well, 60 to 40 or 6 to 40, it's still okay. But I mean, we need that's why. How can we say that? We need to be more objective than that. And so the chi-squared test is useful for significance studies. We move on, page 56, energy flow. As already mentioned, ecosystems concerning energy are open systems, and the energy enters an ecosystem over light energy. And then it is passed on from so-called trophic level to trophic level. So, and now let's have a look at this here. At the diagram on the top part on page 56, there's a little diagram over here. We start over here on the left. Light energy enters the system by photosynthesis, and then the plants, they capture the light energy and they produce organic matter in the producers. And then other animals eat the plant. So the arrow goes to the right where it says energy and organic matter in primary consumers. Now the question is now, what happens next? The next level would be, well, secondary consumers. So the energy is passed on from trophic level to trophic level. So what else can happen with the energy? The energy can be given off as heat, and also some energy can be lost because the animal or the organism dies, and then it's the material is decomposed. Those organisms that make organic substances, the autotrophs, in other words, they are referred to as producers. Now let's have a more closer detail in the next box, energy losses. How can energy be lost from trophic level to trophic level? Again, we look at the diagram. Maybe we should look at the top diagram first. It says here, energy and organic matter eaten by primary consumers. This is what I just mentioned. And then it goes on, the energy, these primary consumers are eaten by secondary consumers. So the energy goes into the secondary consumers. And it says energy and organic matter in the tissues of the primary consumers. And then it goes into the secondary consumers. And now what can happen to this energy? This energy can be lost as heat because the organisms, they do cell respiration. And also some organisms die. And then when they die, the material is decomposed and energy is given off again as heat over cell respiration. So we have a general overview diagram at the bottom. Okay, so we have producers, primary consumers, and secondary consumers. You see their feeding relationships. Each one of them does cell respiration to produce heat. And because of death, loss of tissues and feces, waste produced, this goes to the detritivores and saprotrophs. They decompose this, they do cell respiration, and again, heat is produced. So energy enters an ecosystem over light energy and it leaves it over heat. Okay, that is basically the idea of this diagram. We move on to the next page, page 57, top, about trophic levels and food chains. You should know one sample food chain, and they're giving you one over here. At the beginning of a food chain, you have always the producer, which is usually a plant or some photosynthetic organism, like other photosynthetic organisms, like, for example, blue-green algae or certain other phototrophic bacteria. Then we have a primary consumer, secondary consumer, and tertiary consumer. And the energy is always passed on from trophic level to trophic level. Please be aware that the arrows indicate the flow of the energy. And please also be aware that we do not include the sun in a food chain. And we also do not include detritivores and saprotrophs in a food chain, because it's kind of clear that they are decomposers. So it's totally not necessary. Okay. So if they ask you identify the trophic level of the lizard, then you're going to say, well, the lizard is a secondary consumer. Okay. You also have the so-called the terminal consumers, and these are the last ones. In this case, it's the tertiary consumer, it's the terminal consumer, it's the jaguar. That is one way of representing energy flow. The second way of representing energy flow is the energy pyramids, which is on the bottom of page 57. And one thing that you have to know is that from trophic level to trophic level, only about 10% of the energy is passed on, because the rest is lost in the form of heat, waste, and because of death before the organism is consumed by the next trophic level, as I already mentioned. And this is the reason why the pyramid goes together so quickly. And now to look at the energy units, you have to know the units. And this is a kilojoules per square meter per year. So if you look at a square meter per year, then this area of land has a certain energy content, because there are certain animals or plants living there. Also, you can also say, well, it's also the sunlight that is captured by this area over the course of 1 year. And the width of the bar tells you something about the total biomass. So for example, we look at the top pyramid down here. It says your producers 87,000 kilojoules per square meter per year, and the primary consumers only have around 14,000. So you can see it goes together quite steeply, and the bar indicates the total amount of energy, and the energy can be represented by the biomass. Last word was biomass. I kind of cut it short a little bit here. Okay, so we flip the page. Page 58, nutrient cycles. As I mentioned before, the flow of energy, concerning energy, an ecosystem is an open system. Energy leaves and enters the ecosystem. Concerning nutrients, however, it is a closed system, because nutrients are recycled. Okay, so that is basically the top box, top left box, nutrients recycling in ecosystems. Okay, so it says here energy is supplied to ecosystems in the form of light, and it leaves it by heat. And concerning nutrients, an ecosystem is a closed system, because there's a limited supply of nutrients. So the next thing that we have is the following, is carbon sources in air and water. We need carbon dioxide in the air, of course, because plants need the carbon dioxide for photosynthesis, and also there are water plants, so carbon dioxide is also important in water. And what the autotrophs do is the following. They absorb the carbon dioxide, either from the atmosphere or from the water, and then it is converted to glucose, or to carbohydrates, to organic material by photosynthesis. However, in aquatic ecosystems, we are also taking away the form of carbon dioxide the carbon dioxide is also converted to so-called carbonic acid. And this is an acid, so the more carbon dioxide that we have in water, the more acidic the water becomes. So carbon dioxide is not only available in the water in the form of CO2, but also in the form of carbonate ions, hydrogen carbonate ions. Okay. So the carbon cycle is the big next picture over here. And what we do is we start off with CO2 in the air and water, and by photosynthesis, that's the arrow going away to the right, we have carbon compounds in producers, okay? And these producers, these plants, they will also do cell respiration, and they will give off carbon dioxide again. However, in the process of feeding, these carbon compounds in producers can also be then taken up into consumers, animals, and they, this process is called feeding, and they also do cell respiration and produce CO2 again. The plants and the animals, they can also die, and then the carbon can be found in the saprotrophic bacteria and fungi, and they will do again cell respiration, and they will produce CO2. And you can see that the CO2, or the carbon actually, is cycling. We're not adding and we're not removing any carbon dioxide. So another thing that is the next book is methane in the carbon cycle. So far, I don't see any methane. We only talk about CO2. But you have to understand that methane is also an important source of carbon, and the so-called methanogenic archaeans. These are bacteria, or actually these are not classical bacteria. Let's say more correctly, they're prokaryotes. What they do is they break down organic material and they produce methane. Okay, so that is also given off in the carbon into the atmosphere, and this is a very strong greenhouse gas. And also combustion in the carbon cycle, that's the box on the right. Combustion is burning of organic materials. So for example, it is possible that over forest fires or the burning of fossil fuels, we are adding CO2 into the carbon cycle in the form, yeah, and this starts to build up. However, it is like this that we are also removing a little bit of CO2 over photosynthesis, but this cannot compensate often the amount of CO2 which is produced by combustion, by burning. Okay. Okay, let's move on to page 59, the carbon cycle. Atmospheric monitoring is the top box. Essentially, this box says that the CO2 levels can be monitored and can be measured. And measuring is done over so-called air monitoring stations. Okay, and because of that, we know that what the concentration of the CO2 is in the air. During the summertime, when the photosynthesis is high, more CO2 is removed. And during wintertime, when organic material decomposes, the CO2 level increases. Now it is like this, that these fluctuations can be measured, of course. And so there is an up and down, annual up down cycle of the CO2. It is like this, that the northern hemisphere of the planet Earth has more land area. So there is also more photosynthesis going on the northern hemisphere. And therefore the northern and southern hemispheres are not able to completely compensate each other, because when it's north and northern hemisphere summer, it's winter in the southern hemisphere. But these effects are not able to completely compensate each other, because the northern hemisphere has a higher land area and therefore also more photosynthesis going on. Okay, this is just side information here. But in any case, there are annual fluctuations due to photosynthesis and decomposition in wintertime. Carbon fluxes in the carbon cycle, on page 59 on the right side. What you have in the table over here is the gigatons per year in change. So photosynthesis has around, removes 120 gigatons per year of carbon from the atmosphere, and cell respiration adds approximately the same amount to the atmosphere, so this cancels out. The oceans are also able to take up a lot of carbon dioxide, but also they're giving off a lot of carbon dioxide as well, so that also balances out. Deforestation and land use changes, so cutting down of trees and burning them down with fires, adds about 1.6 gigatons per year, and fossil fuels, which includes oil and coal, adds another 6.4 gigatons. So you can see that deforestation and land use and the combustion of fossil fuels, they add to the carbon cycle. Okay, so that's why there is an increase in CO2 in the air. So now the biogeochemical carbon cycle, which you can see on the bottom, in the middle of the page, is an extension of the carbon cycle of page 58. Okay, so you still have the CO2 in the atmosphere there at the top. You have the carbon compounds in producers by photosynthesis, the carbon compounds in saprotrophs, also the carbon compounds in consumers. So you do have the original carbon cycle in there. However, we're adding a few other components as well. And let's go to the bottom left. It says your calcium carbonate in limestone. So this is formed by fossilization, and this also removes carbon. However, breakdown by acid is able to release the carbon again in the form of CO2. Also, for example, the carbon compounds in consumers can be partially decomposed to make oil and gas in shale. And also the carbon compounds in producers and plants can form partially decomposed organic matter, which is called peat, which can then form coal. Okay, and the oil and the gas and the coal, all the way on the right side, can be burned again to add to the CO2 in the atmosphere. And also, it is also possible to convert the peat by methanogenesis by certain bacteria, archaea, that's by certain prokaryotes. I gotta be careful here because I'm a microbiologist, and archaea and bacteria, two different things here. Side information. It can be converted to methane. Okay, so archaea are prokaryotes. I just wanted to make this clear. And so the archaea are very similar to bacteria, but strictly speaking, you're not allowed to say that archaea are bacteria because they're not quite related to each other. That's very detailed now. Now, what is the point here? The point, it looks like a cycle here. However, one thing that you have to understand is that this fossilization that we have over here is a very slow process. So the making of coal for is fossilization is very slow. However, the combustion of fossil fuels is very fast. So while the fossilization might take millions of years, the burning of fossil fuels has been extensively done since for a few hundred years now, which caused the CO2 in the atmosphere to greatly increase. So, page 59, bottom left, limestone in the carbon cycle. So limestone is calcium carbonate, it's CaCO3, and that contains carbon. And it is like this, that in water, in the oceans, the CO2, which goes into the water, forms carbonic acid, and plus calcium carbonate and calcium, it makes this limestone, and this limestone then settles down on the floor of the ocean, and this also removes carbon from the system. However, more CO2 is added over volcanic eruptions, so there is a separate cycle over here. We're removing carbon on one hand by the forming of limestone. On the other hand, we are releasing again CO2 into the atmosphere by volcanic eruptions. So this kind of also balances out. Page 59, bottom right, formation of fossil fuels. I already mentioned this very briefly. Peat, coal, oil and gas. These form mainly under anaerobic conditions. This means if there is not enough oxygen present, then the organic materials cannot fully decompose, because full decomposition requires oxygen, and if this is not present, we have peat, coal, oil and gas formation. And because we cannot completely oxidize it, they still store a lot of the energy, and that's why it's used for fossil fuels. Let's move on to page 60. Global warming and the greenhouse effect. Top box, the greenhouse effect. So the greenhouse effect works like this. Sunlight is converted to heat by the so-called greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And the gases, the higher the concentration of these gases, the more of the heat is trapped in the atmosphere, and therefore the atmospheric temperature goes up. And since the Industrial Revolution, humans have been dumping CO2 gas into the atmosphere in large amounts, and therefore in this carbon dioxide, this CO2 is a greenhouse gas, and therefore the atmospheric temperature has gone up. And there are studies that show quite convincingly that if the CO2 level is higher, then also the atmospheric temperature is higher. It is like this, that so now we move on to the next box, greenhouse gases. And you see a pie chart over there, and you see that carbon dioxide with 63.4% contributes most to the greenhouse effect. Then also methane, also nitrous oxide and halocarbons, they are also greenhouse gases. However, the most important greenhouse gas is not included in here because it's kind of difficult to measure its effect, and that is water vapor. Water vapor is a very contributes a lot to the greenhouse effect, and it's very important to have this water vapor in the atmosphere because it makes sure that the Earth is actually warmer than it normally would be without the water vapor. So it makes life possible. However, the problem that we have nowadays is that there is too much CO2 and methane in the atmosphere, which contribute to the enhanced greenhouse effect. So the greenhouse effect is not bad. But the problem is that the enhanced greenhouse effect has led to climate change. So first of all, another important thing that is important to mention here is methane itself per molecule is a much stronger greenhouse gas than CO2. However, the concentration of methane is still very low in the atmosphere, and therefore the overall effect that it has is not as high as carbon dioxide, but per molecule methane is a stronger greenhouse gas, but its concentration is much lower. The next diagram, bottom box, page 60, global warming and climate change. And what we have is over here is the mean global temperature over the years since 1880. And you can see that there is a general trend which is upwards. Now, on the x-axis, we have the mean global temperature. And the thing is, the following is, it's deviation from the mean. Okay, that is also important to understand. So I think it's a little bit confusing. The the y-axis, I mean, not the x-axis, the y-axis, because the mean global temperature in 1880 was not minus 0.2 degrees centigrade. The units are also missing here, so this is a really bad graph. Because it was not minus 0.2 degrees, but it was 0.2 degrees colder than over the recorded average. And the average goes all the way up to the year 2000 and something, okay? So that is important, yeah, to understand here. So it's kind of deviation from the mean, and if zero, the 0 degrees would be that there is a 0 degree difference from the average. So over the whole time span since 1880 to 2000, the average is of course zero, yeah, because you're averaging everything, yeah, and everything which is less than zero is colder than the average, and everything which is above zero is warmer than the average. And so you can see that in the year 2000 around, we have a 0.6 degrees higher than average temperature. Okay, and so we move on to the next page, page 61. And on page 61, we talk about rising carbon dioxide concentrations. And what you can see over here is that there are two graphs over here. And you see that the temperature curve and the carbon dioxide concentrations, basically they correlate. So if the CO2 level is high, then the temperature is also high. First of all, question number one, how do you actually know the temperature of such a long time ago? And how do you know the CO2 concentration? And there are basically, the CO2 is trapped in the ice cores. So they're digging them out from the polar regions, and you can get the atmospheric CO2 concentration from long time ago. And you can use you can also use the tree rings. You can study tree rings to also assess the temperature of a long time ago, because the thicker the tree ring, the higher the average temperature. So there are certain methods how you can do that. Now, for many years, there has been a debate now, is this a correlation or a causation? Just because two curves behave the same way does not mean that one causes the other thing to happen. Maybe it is like this, that an increase in temperature also somehow causes the CO2 level to go up. But this is now, there's now evidence that this is not, that there is a causation and not only correlation. Okay. And so that is the next thing that I have to go on, is on page 61, bottom left box, carbon emissions and global warming. And it is like this, that since the Industrial Revolution, the carbon dioxide released has significantly gone up due to the burning of fossil fuels. And this also correlates very well with the increase in global temperature. Now, the effect of global warming on coral reefs and carbon dioxide, the box on the right side, has to lead to so-called coral bleaching. Coral reefs are very, very sensitive to even small amounts in temperature change. So this means that coral bleaching is when the corals start to die off due to temperature change, and also possibly due to changes in the CO2 level. Okay, because do not forget that if there is a CO2 increase also in the oceans, then this also lowers the pH, because the CO2 makes the water more acidic. And these effects have led to basically coral reefs being, because of the acid, the calcium carbonate in the coral reefs has been also broken. Has been broken down, and this is also an effect of global warming and climate change, and also the increased level of CO2. So this was chapter 4, a quick run through to chapter 4, half an hour again that I used for this chapter, and I wish you a nice day.